So, what a beautiful day. It's pretty nice to be here, isn't it? I've really become very fond of this place. Last year, we explored the connection between our bodies, the earth, and healing. And this year, I thought it would be nice to extend that exploration into an exploration of the voice, our voices, and the voices of other beings. And silence, you know, because of course we spend a lot of time sitting in silence. But we are also called upon to express our practice in the world. That's our bodhisattva vow. With our actions, with our speech, and sometimes with our restraint. So we need to kind of work that movement between silence and speech and action. And here in this sort of living environment of forest and water and stone and mountains, it's a pretty good place to do that. So I'm going to talk for a while, but then we're also going to do some experiential exercises with our voices, and I'm also going to draw a lot on the voices and writings of women who have inspired me a lot over the years, particularly as they articulate what it is to lose one's voice, find one's voice, and use one's voice in the world. I think this topic was kind of up for me because of what's been going on in public life with the Me Too movement and many women speaking out in various ways in our world today. The Me Too movement started in what's called the entertainment industry. Isn't that an odd thing to have? I don't think, in earlier times of human history, there was an entertainment industry. But that's where it started, with women in film and TV acting, who learned that there's often a price tag attached to entrance into success in one's chosen career or art form, and that price is access to your body by a man in position of power. And other voices have joined in from diverse fields, right? Politics, labor, the arts, publishing, religion, academia. It's a long list of women and men too, speaking about their experiences of sexual harassment, assault, gender-based or sexuality-based discrimination, speaking about the consequences they'd face when they'd spoken out in the past, speaking about being silenced. I think women all over the world felt viscerally during the hearings on the nomination of Brett Kavanaugh to the U.S. Supreme Court, listening to the testimony of Christine Blasey Ford and the disrespect and dismissal of her words. Have you ever lost your voice? And I don't mean just a bad case of laryngitis. About halfway through high school, I kind of stopped talking. I maintained a functional facade, but it was, I didn't talk any more than I had to. And I became very closed off to those around me. Not sharing my inner thoughts or feelings, not using my voice less and less, stopping singing, stopping writing, almost. I became a good listener. A lot of good listeners become good listeners by silencing themselves. You've got to watch that. I also became determined to render myself unrecognizable as the smart, verbally adept young woman I was. It wasn't until maybe five years later, I'm guessing, when a man who had just read the I Ching for me said to me, "You are the most nonverbal person I've ever met." And my jaw kind of dropped open. I thought, oh, I've succeeded. I have rendered myself unrecognizable as smart and verbal. You know, which to me had been a jeopardy. So I thought, okay, I guess it's time to turn this around. And so I began slowly to figure out how to speak in the world. Some of you have some variation on a story of a time when you became quite silent. The core of our practice is sitting in silence, being mindful of our moment-to-moment experience, sensations, perceptions, emotions, thoughts, as they arise and pass, without grasping on, without pushing away. And you may have noticed that much of your mental activity while sitting in zazen takes the form of words. How many have noticed? Yada, yada, yada. Of course, images are there too. Images float in and out of our awareness, but at least in my experience, I don't grab onto them as much, right? They're more like passing clouds, the images. It's the words, you know, that I think we obsess more with and perseverate. An image arising can trigger a word or a whole narrative, or a word and a phrase can evoke an image, or a whole movie from our past. I have wondered if in pre-literate societies people had less trouble with incessantly chatty minds. You know, if women could sit in a courtyard and weave a basket with a quiet mind, you know, looking up now and then at a child's cry or a bird's call, but quiet, you know, in companionable quiet. Or maybe to tell a story, but I just suspect that people's minds were generally quieter. In pre-literate societies, even in pre-electronic media societies, which I think electronic media have also, I wonder, conditioned our verbal mind to replay and rehearse. Replay, rehearse, replay, rehearse a lot. We do that in zazen sometimes. So yeah, so of course it's not so easy for the mind to quiet, and yet it does. It does. Over and over again, in Zen teachings, we hear that words are not to be trusted. That as soon as we put an experience into words, we've already betrayed the truth. Have you ever heard the old Latin phrase, traduttore, traditore? Translator, traitor. Translator, traitor. Translator is a traitor. Words are the medium we use to translate our experience and communicate it to others. Words plus all the nonverbal, you know, it's said that 60% of communication is nonverbal, is gesture, expression, tone. But still, we rely a lot on words, and sometimes we get snagged and stuck in them. So in Zen, words are said to be the finger pointing at the moon being the clear light of awakening, and for us not to mistake the finger for the moon, right? Bodhidharma, the Indian monk who brought Zen meditation from India to China in the 8th century, called Zen a special transmission independent of words and scriptures. So in some Zen circles, that comes to be expressed as a kind of dismissal of text or reading. But that's not exactly it. It's the way we hold those words and the way we use those words. And Zen, despite that, has produced a huge amount of literature and stories, many, many stories of Zen masters and their disciples playing with words and silence in ways that they're often in dialogue, right? In ways that sort of jar us loose from our attachments to words and our dualistic thinking. The old stories are filled with challenges to speak. Say a true Zen word, or sometimes it's called a turning word that stops us from our habitual patterns and opens us up. Something that's authentic and that nudges us out of our habitual self-focus. So one of the classic stories that asks for for the monks in the story to speak is the famous story of Nan Chuan and the cat. In this story, the abbot Nan Chuan came in to the monastery and found the monks of the East Hall and the West Hall arguing over a cat. Doesn't say what, why. I don't know if they wanted to adopt the cat. And they each group wanted the cat. But Nan Chuan said, "Listen, all of you, if you can say something, I will spare this cat. And if you can't, I will cut off its head." And the monks blanked. Nobody knew what to say. And he cut the cat in two. Now, Zen people ever since have been arguing over, did this really happen? Surely he's not carrying a sword around. Or did he mime it? These are dramas that are played out. And we can't necessarily take them literally. So people have been arguing about that for a long time. We'll never know. But the point is that the monks froze. Nobody was brave enough to say, stop. Don't cut the cat. Let the cat go. Let the cat choose where it wants to live. But the story continues. That evening, a monk named Jiajiao came back to the monastery from somewhere, and Nan Chuan told him what had happened. And Jiajiao took one of his sandals off, put it on his head, and walked out. Now that sounds all very cryptic and weird and Zen, but apparently in ancient China, to put your sandal on your head, and I can't say why, don't know, was a symbol of mourning. So he said something without words, with a gesture that said, perhaps, well, that's a terrible story. I feel awful about that story. We don't know. But he spoke with a gesture. And Nan Chuan said, if you had been there, the cat would have been spared. So we'll come back to this koan later. It's always been a little bit of a disturbing one because, you know, it's talking about violence to an animal and that's disturbing. I have gradually come to love and really appreciate these old Zen stories. But all along, I felt they're a little bit limited by the near absence of women's voices and experiences in them. You know, what's a turning word in our experience? What's an opening? Those stories are left out so often in the literature. And so two of our great women Zen friends in the San Francisco area, Sue Moon and Florence Kaplow, did a great labor of love and researched and compiled stories from our Buddhist women ancestors, not just Zen, but from the beginning, from ancient to modern times, and they called the book The Hidden Lamp. So, in a sense, writing the balance and giving us some other possible stories of speaking up, of awakening. So we'll look at some of them later on. In our everyday lives as women or as human beings, we see plenty of ways words get us into trouble. And we can also see ways silence gets us into trouble. Silence in our practice is stillness and spaciousness, all-inclusiveness. But silence in our karmic lives is not always golden. It can be unwholesome, it can be quite toxic. So we need words sometimes to break those silences, sometimes to save our lives. Susan Griffin, an American poet and writer, talks about the difference between these two kinds of silence quite beautifully. She says, silences, not the silences between notes of music, or the silences of a sleeping animal, or the calm of a glassy surfaced river, witnessing the outstretched wings of a heron. Not the silence of an emptied mind, but this other silence, that silence which can feel like a scream in which there is no peace. The grim silence between two lovers who are quarreling. The painful silence of the one with tears in her eyes who will not cry. The silence of the child who knows she will not be heard. The silence of a whole people who have been massacred. Of a whole sex made mute or not educated to speech. The silence of a mind afraid to admit truth to itself. This is the silence the poet dreads. So what stops us? What stops us from expressing ourselves freely and authentically? 40 years ago, a woman named Tilly Olson published a book called Silences. Some of you may know it and some of you may not, but it's a classic now, and it's a study of silences in writers' lives, particularly women writers' lives, but she also speaks of male writers who were silenced in their writing lives, you know, who began and then cut off, never wrote again, that kind of thing. And these are some of the her description of these kinds of silences. She says, literary history and the present are dark with silences. Some, the silences for years by our acknowledged great, so that means great writers, but who had long periods of silence. Some silences hidden. Some, the ceasing to publish after one work appears. Some, the never coming to book form at all. You know, some who were never published until after they died. Emily Dickinson. These are not natural silences, that necessary time for renewal, lying fallow, gestation in the natural cycle of creation. The silences I speak of here are unnatural, the unnatural thwarting of what struggles to come into being, but cannot. In the old, the obvious parallels, when the seed strikes stone, the soil will not sustain. The spring is false. The time is drought or blight or infestations. the frost comes premature. So of course she's using the metaphors of growth to talk about our growth in our humanity, in our writing, our art, in our work. And then she lists varieties of silences: censorship silences, political silences, silences of the marginal, absences that are a kind of silence, premature silences, foreground silences, silences where the lives never come to writing. And then she quotes another poet, Louise Bogen: "The knife of the perfectionist attitude in art and life." Another silencer. The knife of the perfectionist attitude in art and life. Our personal silences are nested like those Russian dolls. So nested inside those of our mothers and our grandmothers. Generations of women in our culture and history. Susan Griffin, who I just quoted, wrote an amazing book called A Chorus of Stones. Anyone ever read that? It's probably at least 20 years old. A Chorus of Stones, The Private Life of War. And she explores the way that cultural and historical silences and family and personal silences all are woven together in our lives. The trauma and denials and avoidances of war, particularly on the international scale, and violence and abuse on the domestic scale. And she weaves partly through her own family story and what she discovered about those layers, generational layers of trauma, and the effect on family life that had. And here's what she says. "It is said that the close study of stone will reveal traces from fires suffered thousands of years ago. I am beginning to believe that we know everything, that all history, including the history of each family, is part of us, such that when we hear any secret revealed, a secret about a grandfather or uncle, or a secret about the Battle of Dresden in 1945, our lives are made suddenly clearer to us as the unnatural heaviness of unspoken truth is dispersed. For perhaps we are like stones, our own history and the history of the world embedded in us. We hold a sorrow deep within and cannot weep until that history is sung." What an image, the traces in stone going back and back are in our bodies as well, in a similar way. So each of us has a part of that history to sing, right? Because no story is isolated from the big story, right? We each are part of that, of what she calls the chorus of stones. And sometimes we must sing for those who did not or could not, the very ones who bequeathed us the legacy of silence. Another wonderful writer, Terry Tempest Williams. Anybody know that name? Yeah. Lost her mother to breast cancer. She her most famous book, the one that brought her into the public light, it was called Refuge, and she wove together her history of her Mormon family with the history of nuclear testing in Utah and the history of breast cancer in her family. So again, weaving together. So she lost her mother to breast cancer when her mother was 54 and she herself was 32. So that's too young. It's always, I don't know when there's ever a good time to lose your mom, but 32 is still pretty young. And a week before her mother died, her mother called Terry to her bedside and told her she was leaving her all her journals. But she made her promise not to read them before her death. So a month after her mother died, Terry went to the bookshelf, and this is where the journals were, and this is what she writes. They were exactly where she said they would be. Three shelves of beautiful cloth-bound books, some floral, some paisley, some others in solid colors. The spines of each were perfectly aligned against the lip of the shelves. I opened the first journal. It was empty. I opened the second journal. It was empty. I opened the third. It, too, was empty, as was the fourth, fifth, the sixth, shelf after shelf after shelf. All my mother's journals were blank. What a chilling legacy. So when Terry reached the age her mother had been when she died, which is often a very significant year for people to reach that age when they've lost a parent young, having published 14 books herself, she wrote a book called When Women Were Birds, 54 Variations on Voice. To find a way to give voice to this mysterious legacy from her mother. She says, we all have our secrets. To withhold words is power. But to share our words with others openly and honestly is also power. So this is a powerful book for me because my own mother, who's now 95, over the span of about probably 2 years in her late 80s, did a kind of life review. I think she was pretty depressed. She was rereading her decades of diaries. Seven decades of bound day books, utilitarian, not pretty, no paisley covers, maybe green or red or blue, lined, just with about this much for each day, those kind. She read them one by one, often weeping. I hope she laughed some too, and throwing them away. Despite my protests, I don't live nearby, so I would protest over the phone, she threw them all out, hinting of dark times and feelings best not seen by others. There was one she didn't throw out that I have. It was the one the year my sister died, and I don't think it felt right for her to throw that out. They were filled with her neat handwriting, which in recent years had become a scrawl, which was one reason why she stopped. Along with her declining ability to remember what she had done just the day before. So she couldn't. It became frustrating to record. But she used to record weather, chores done, birds seen, camping trips taken, and probably some painful aspects of her marriage to which she could not give voice. There are profound social, psychosocial levels of prescription, stigma, and shame for many. A psychologist named Dana Crowley Jack wrote a book called Silencing the Self, Women and Depression. And in that book, she describes how mothers teach their daughters how to suppress their authentic voice in order to maintain a relationship with the husband and father. In her words, to silence or diminish themselves as a way to attain and maintain a type of intimacy within inequality. Does that make sense? To maintain this connection within inequality requires a silencing, a diminishment. Yeah. And this she saw over and over again in the women who were struggling with depression, whom she worked with and studied. The women were often, she found, in relationships with men who were both very dominating, but also very dependent on their wives, to be weak and submissive. So that combination. And the women repeatedly described their experience as a loss of self and a loss of voice. Initially a choice made in order to maintain that relationship, but increasingly eroding of confidence and capacity to function well in their lives. So, fathers teach silence, mothers teach silence, society teaches silence. My mother for years felt obligated to follow my father's rules for communication because she felt, in a sense, indebted to him for marrying her. And she was an orphan with nothing to her name but her clothing and the green balloon-tired bicycle she had proudly bought with her first secretarial check. So it was a big imbalance there. Even though he was not a powerful man, there was an imbalance. Andrea Olson, who is a teacher of what she calls, she's a longtime dance and movement teacher, and she developed a way of teaching what she calls experiential anatomy. We did some of this last year from her other book, Body and Earth, and this one's called Body Stories. She does wonderful work. And here's what she has to say about silence. She her mode for in her professional life was movement, and speaking didn't come easy to her. She says, "My way of perceiving the world was silent. As children, we would pile out of the car on vacations, line up on a rock, and stare scenically and silently into the distance. My father was a painter, my mother a first grade teacher. Somehow sight dominated sound in my early experiences. We have many such photos in our family album. These silent children on a rock. Can't you picture it?" So we've all received lessons, right? Blatant, subtle. Rebecca Solnit, who's one of the most perceptive and articulate writers I know of currently, wrote an essay called "Men Explain Things to Me." Anybody know this one? Okay, well, I'll just review it a little. She describes an experience she once had at a party where she and her friend, both of them 40-ish, were the youngest present among a distinguished and very well-to-do crowd at a well-appointed alpine chalet in Aspen, Colorado. At that point, Solnit had already published 6 or 7 books, and in conversation, she made reference to the subject of her latest book without mentioning the book itself or her authorship. Their host began to hold forth on this very important new book on that topic. And this is what she says: "So caught up was I in my assigned role of the ingenue that I was perfectly willing to entertain the possibility that another book on the same subject had come out simultaneously and I'd somehow missed it." Have you ever had that experience of backing off from something you know perfectly well in deference to someone else's ego? So this man continued to hold forth, and she writes, "eyes fixed on the fuzzy horizon of his own authority," until her friend tried to interrupt, but it's her book, she wrote the book. And he didn't pick up on it. She had to say it 3 or 4 times before he turned gray and speechless for a moment, and then incredibly resumed pontificating about her book, which it turned out he hadn't even read, but had only read the New York Times Book Review. It's a pretty funny story, I guess. She concludes her story, "Being women, we were politely out of earshot before we started laughing, and we've never really stopped." But then she goes on. She says, "I've had a lot more confirmation of my right to think and speak than most women. And I've learned that a certain amount of self-doubt is a good tool for correcting, understanding, listening, and progressing. Though too much self-doubt is paralyzing and total, too much is paralyzing, and total self-confidence produces arrogant idiots." She said, "There's a happy medium between these two poles, there's a happy medium between these two poles to which the genders have been pushed, a warm equatorial belt of give and take where we should all meet." Few of us in our upbringing learned how to function in that middle ground of give and take. I didn't. You're lucky if you did learn that, you know, that middle ground of give and take growing up. Most of us have to learn it as we go in our adult relationships. And even here among us where we're not terribly diverse group, but surely within us there are differences of generation, class, education, and privilege that may factor into our sense of being entitled to have a say in our lives, in our world. Our mothers teach us by what they say, how they say it, what they don't say, but most of all by example. Some of us learn silence from our mothers, or subterfuge and indirection. Some of us learned to speak out, to write, paint, sing, create, to offer our work to the world from our mothers or our grandmothers or an aunt or someone. And that's what tomorrow night will bring, honoring some of those women who did give us courage. I keep quoting poets because poetry is the way words come closest to expressing the paradoxical beauty and terror and pathos of our world. Jane Cooper is a poet who wrote a book of poetry in her 20s but did not publish a single poem until she was 44. She says, "We are not separate, and the work for all of us must begin, I think, with the stripping down of words, with listening, with acknowledging our fear, with getting back to origins, with learning to live, however perilously, in this moment, for it is our only life." She probably never practiced Zen, as far as I know, but she was listening to some Dharma one way or another. So, what I'd like us to do now is use our voices a little and